So, this is the panel entitled Against Whiteness Again, which I originally thought was a typographical error. Then I realized that some people present were against whiteness a few decades ago. And here we are, back again, against whiteness again. Amiri, you want to say something so we can... Can we hear you?
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Ah, beautiful. So Amiri's going to set the table, and then Shimon and I are going to give some comments, and then hopefully we can open it up for discussion as quickly as possible. So you want to take it away, Amiri?
Yeah. So I'll go real quick. I wrote a little thing, so I'll just mostly read it. To define what whiteness is, I'm going to go over a brief history of it in the United States. Then bring it back up to the past
election. Is that us? Hold on one second. We're going to raise this out.
Okay. Is that better?
Yes.
Okay. So first I'm going to define whiteness and bring it back up through history and to the past election. So whiteness is a protection racket that used to provide material bonuses. It's a minimally advantageous deal that the ruling class continually renegotiates with a part of the working class, and the first such deal happened before the founding of the United States. I'm thinking of the Virginia Codes of 1705 in response to Bacon's Rebellion, during which some black and white colonists united against the governing aristocrat at Berkeley. The carrot was material advantage, i.e. less disadvantage, and the stick was death by official hanging or lynching throughout the 1960s. Now, the vast majority of white folks are not personally malignantly prejudiced, but they are still more or less aligned with white supremacy and take the privileges such as they are. So like I said, whiteness has gone through several large renegotiations, like the integration of the Irish and also the Civil War, the resolution of which required the sacrifice of the democratic hopes of the radical Republicans and their abolitionist vision for the country, and therefore also of freed slaves in the Compromise of 1877. So the romantic Southern gentlemen rebels would be ideologically redeemed over the next couple of decades, and I guess their crowning achievement of their redemption was the movie Birth of a Nation. And so that settled some of the new immigrants back in 1877, who would be part of the newly recomposed white working class, and I say that in quotes, went on the offensive in a railroad strike that very same year, 1877, a wildcat railroad strike. So like Tammany Hall had served for the Irish, the Knights of Labor served as the organizational expression of this part of the working class, and there was a struggle within that group over the race question. They were willing to allow some blacks to join, but they were reluctant and ambivalent, and they're also totally anti-Chinese out west. So then there was Sam Gompers' unambiguously racist AFL, American Federation of Labor. And so you could say that the AFL took the skilled section of the workers from the Knights of Labor, and the unskilled section of the workers were unrepresented until the appearance of the Wobblies in the transition from craft to industrial unionism. The Wobblies were openly and strongly anti-racist, and they were the only labor organization not to fall victim to white supremacy in the manner of the Knights and all the other organizations that followed. Now, their anti-racism wasn't an ideology, and it wasn't like a liberal thing. It wasn't a bunch of slogans, but it was real, because, and even though they were passionate about it, but it was also a necessity of their open and aggressively anti-capitalist revolutionary stance. And obviously, revolution requires the mobilization of the entire working class, so they were openly cognizant of this fact. So, appropriately, one of the founders of the Wobblies was Lucy Parsons, a black woman. In any case, the final acceptance of workers' combinations and the repeal of prohibition were the last major expansions of whiteness, and we know that these took place during the Great Depression and World War II. So whiteness is an artifact of class struggle that does not challenge white supremacy. It is not bound to ethnicity or culture, though it does carry an identity of a sort, a blankness and a kind of obliviousness that's normal in the context of a thoroughly commercial, fully capitalized American culture. White ethnicity of origin become mostly decorations. So that potted history above is the story of white man's democracy. Small government populist and Indian killer Andrew Jackson epitomizes this vision of American life with free white men competing on a free white market on a continent under manifest destiny and the divine dispensation, where political parties reward their loyal allies with patronage and machine appointments when they're in power. This sounds familiar because it's mother's milk in the United States. So the New Deal was the last major component of white man's democracy, and it worked for a while, particularly to cultivate a layer of business-friendly union officials and to exclude revolutionaries on the left from the unions. That was during the bright midday of U.S. imperialism, and whiteness was a kind of state-subsidized illusion of Jeffersonian, Jacksonian independence and solid self-reliance. But this white man's democracy came under attack in the transition from the post-war boom to the new era we live in now. Of course, the elements of the attack were the civil rights movement, black power movement, later, very shortly after, the women's movement, and the most intense period of class struggle since the end of World War II. You can call this era post-war also, if you mean Vietnam, or we can call it neoliberalism like everybody else. The defining characteristics of this era are the assault on the public sphere, including all the gains of white man's democracy, and thereby the contraction of social reproduction. This is like the developed world capitalism going cannibalistic. So this attack of the ruling class on the working class in motion, the whole working class, and sometimes even under black leadership in Detroit and Ottawa, wildcat strikes in Detroit, across the country in civil service like the post office and in trucking, like in the Teamsters strike, like the grape and lettuce fields, agricultural sector. This whole attack against this whole working class was necessitated by three things. Number one, international competition to U.S. capital. Japan and Germany had rebuilt by now. And the tensions had been building since the late 50s, actually, but it didn't become like important and unavoidable until the debts from Vietnam, which is number two, wartime deficit spending. And then three, higher wages, which were the fruits of working class militancy throughout this post-war period, but especially at the end. So the crisis took the form of consumer goods inflation and weak economic growth, and then layoffs, unemployment, and industrial reorganization, including factory relocation to the American South and to other countries, including in the Western Hemisphere South. Life in the ghettos was that much more precarious because black workers, migrants from the South in two large chunks in the 20s and the 40s, were already the last hired and first fired. Now, Nixon's Southern strategy was inspired by George Wallace's 1968 populist campaign, and that provided the ideological script for what came next, which was a reassertion of whiteness, by which he meant patriotism, war, and reaction, and whiteness as a neglected public value, and white folks as a neglected citizens, and a silent majority. So there were no longer any new material benefits to expect from this compact, okay? Just were wrongs to right, you know, offenses to rebuff, and property to defend. So the economic crisis did the rest. Social disintegration from this economic transition occurred, manifested in crime, drug use, public disorder, and so white flight from city centers to suburbs, formally incentivized by the New Deal mortgage policy and the Federal Housing Authority, continued throughout the 70s. Racial discrimination, segregation, and oppression of all kinds is okay as long as money is the mechanism. And this has become a major theme of American life, you know, after legal discrimination is no longer accepted. In line with that, it didn't take very long for the openly racist Boston anti-busing efforts to become something slick and conservationist and economistically framed, like the bus stop movement in the San Fernando Valley in the late 70s. Which was also an anti-busing, you know, pro-segregation type thing, which was run by the same group of people behind the tax revolt Proposition 13. So they defeated busing in 79. Now, this is the era in which the Sun Belt and the New South take off, and workers move there from all over the country. These states are anti-union states, of course. So what I'm trying to get at is that a sort of siege mentality took hold here, and Nixon's script kind of played. It was the script by which this occurred. Capitalists were having a hard time making a profit, so it was harder to get a job, let alone a good paying job, and those who had them wanted to hold on to them. Ecology and the new movements, identity politics, took hold on what passed for the left, and elsewhere various formations like citizens, consumers, concerned parents, Christians, red-blooded Americans, all these kinds of things dug in. These defensive identities sought to preserve the advantages such as they were of whiteness. I mean, house prices, school budgets, tax dollars, family wages, business opportunities, pensions, union seniority. There were no new material benefits, just defense against them, those people, trying to take your stuff. Now, the end of stagflation didn't restore the good old days. Volcker's interest rate hikes in 79 and super strong dollar put more manufacturers out of business and more workers out on their ear. And the unskilled part of the working class has never recovered. This defensive hunkering down, this defensive attitude, this posture remains the basic posture of whiteness and its associated identities. The ideological script that Nixon introduced and that Reagan reiterated remains in effect. But the declining economic prospects for white workers have required innovations in victim blaming and self-loathing. These have formed the justifications for the nastiness and brutality of public policy since the late 70s, like the end of desegregation policies like busing, the war on drugs, reverse racism, mandatory minimums, the defunding and destruction of public housing, public education, welfare reform, the attacks on teachers, public employees, all that kind of stuff. Now, without getting too psychological, I'm coming toward the end here, but I want to emphasize what I think is the most important aspect of whiteness today, given the fact that the positive material benefits have been declining. And I guess it has to be called a privilege, but it's hard to make the case ultimately, and I hate to say it's privilege because it seems so sad and pathetic. But the plight of the workers is, like everyone, dire, okay? The decline in material benefits is not only evident in job prospects and economic security, like, you know, 401k investments going belly up and your pension being taken away, but also in the wealth lost by white families in the two bubbles and the general indebtedness of the working class. And that was a large part of the New Deal heritage, this creation of a asset base for, you know, quote unquote, middle class families. And that's the last positive piece of white man's democracy, given the capital is reaching ever deeper into workers' lives and pockets. So here's the last privilege. And I hate to call it a privilege, but it's a deadly poison, and it's the sine qua non of whiteness. It's the thing that it depends on and that it's for. And this is the annihilation of solidarity. This is the privilege not to know and not to care. Ignorance. So this know-nothing ignorance is defended vigorously and very often, and it seems like most current ideology has a defense of this privilege as its aim. I've had a couple of conversations recently in which people wanted to bash Trump with me to have sort of virtue signaling circle trip, okay? Where they want to say how bad Trump is and how terrible it is, and don't I agree? And I say, well, hold on, you know, let me start with Obama. What do you think about him? You know, what's your critique of that? So one dude who I said, had this conversation with, I mentioned Obama's despicable use of the civil rights legacy and to liken himself to Martin Luther King, for instance. And I said something like Martin Luther King and Obama are on the same continuum. And this guy, he told me, he said, well, I don't know enough about MLK to make a judgment about that. This is a 50 plus year old man who's been to college, okay? He doesn't know that Martin Luther King would be against drone bombings or immigrant prisons or, you know, deportation. He has no idea, okay? This is what I'm talking about. So this is willful ignorance, and callousness is the object originally purchased by the material benefits of whiteness. But now it seems to function to me like an asset in itself. Now, to make this concrete, this is not just anecdotal. It's not just about consciousness and psychology, but I'm talking also about geographic and spatial situations, like Los Angeles, for instance. I'm sure all of you know that most of the country is not laid out anything like New York. You know, it's most of the country is like LA, where there's suburbs and you can get into your car in the morning, drive to the freeway from your subdivision, drive to work, go to lunch around your office, never see anything else, get back in the car and go back home. And you never have any contact with any other social groups or any other social strata, neighborhoods, geographies, anything like that. So this ignorance is the general anesthetic that allows one to cut off one's own nose to spite one's face and then forget about it. And later, when you're bleeding to death, you look for somebody to blame because you don't know what happened, because you're ignorant and you just have no idea. How did it end up like this? We don't know, right? So this breeds the currents of nastiness and vulgarity that we hate among our class brothers and sisters. And it has to be addressed in some way. I don't know if it can be addressed directly. I mean, I think probably not, because there's so many defenses against political correctness, and there's so many defenses against there's just so many defenses of this privilege that I think it'd probably have to come and struggle, you know. But let's not forget that the whole point of whiteness is to maintain large numbers of workers in this state of callousness and brutality. So back to the present, this past election. Trump has been running the same script as Wallace, Nixon, Reagan. But I think that after almost four decades of economic decline, it seems not to pack the same punch. Reagan won in a landslide, remember. I'm not convinced that Trump voters are more reactionary than Clinton voters because as the Black Agenda Report has been saying, you know, the Democrats are the more effective evil. They can get stuff done that Republicans can never get done. I'm not convinced even that there was a substantially racist swing in the votes in the Midwestern states, if by racism we mean personal prejudice. There's evidence that many of Trump's general voters would have voted for Sanders because, you know, like Macomb County, the legendary Macomb County, many of them voted for Obama and they voted for Sanders in the primary, so they would have taken the better choice had it been offered. I think that we can give them the benefit of the doubt, but, you know, they voted for Sanders in the primaries. So I think that what most likely happened is that this decisive portion of voters decided to throw a stick of dynamite into Washington and see what the hell happened. And I'm not even convinced that the racism and misogyny was even like an added bonus, like a sympathetic resonance with them. I think it was more like, well, yeah, he's misogynist and racist, and those liberals will really hate that, won't they? Something like that, not like they actually agreed with him or cheered him on in those bits of backwardness. So my point is that Trump's victory might look like the silent majority rising, and it might look like people wanting a morning in America, but I don't think it actually is. I don't think there was a positive referendum on anything here. I think it was just a condemnation of the Democrats and, you know, their progressive neoliberalism. And I think the trade in xenophobia might have been more important to these people. However, given that the basic posture of white identity and white supremacy remains in place, and that working class divisions have not been healed suddenly, this is a reason to criticize them for their foolishness. Because America First protectionism, immigrant bashing, and visa revoking are not going to protect anybody from the market. And they should know that. And anybody should be able to think this through. But in the United States, whiteness is the reason they can't. That's the end of my presentation.
Thanks, Amiri. Okay, so.
Hi, Ryan.
Hey, Noel. Okay, so thankfully, Matt and Amiri combined have made a lot of my presentation redundant, which is wonderful, right? There's a zeitgeist. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the Nazi dork and the specific kind of white identity politics that we've seen an uptick of in the last year. And I prepared remarks, but I'll try not to bore you guys by just reading them. All right. So recently, the alt-right media personality Richard Spencer described his ideal society as a revival of the Roman Empire, which would include Russia, Scotland, Finland, and white Americans, just to name a few. This is Spencer's plan for a white ethno-state, accomplished through so-called peaceful ethnic cleansing. Now, this position, which is as horrifying as it is historically illiterate, has been afforded a platform across the mainstream press, pushing the so-called Overton window for acceptable discourse in such a rightward direction that CNN recently ran a headline on its marquee stating flatly, "Alt-right leader questions if Jews are people." Now, when Spencer reacted with such righteous indignation that a video of him being punched in the face was celebrated widely across polite society, I think that he was in part genuinely surprised so many people were rejoicing, given how gently his ideas have been treated otherwise. And so this is a pivotal moment, I would argue, in the battle against whiteness, and it does not appear that we are faring well. Now, Richard Spencer, as you know, is a Trojan horse. He's a white nationalist emissary to mainstream society. And this is a role that he has played with success unparalleled in decades, perhaps even by David Duke himself. Now, this is in part due to his successful rebranding of white nationalism in terms he dubs identitarianism. Spencer maintains that he is not a white supremacist. He simply believes in separation for races and the different cultures they produce. And there's a lot of slippage between race and culture, and I want you to keep that in mind. All Spencer wants, he says, is a land for his people, not unlike Israel. Other groups have their identities, so why not us? Now, some have said that this appropriation of the chic academic jargon of the day, along with his dapper appearance and his prep school mannerisms, which, by the way, were the real reason why people were so happy he got punched in the face. people who do not agree with our critiques of his politics thought it was really funny to see that guy get punched in the face. Anyway, some people say that this simply represents a cosmetic enhancement of rehashed anti-Semitic conspiracy theories and racist pseudoscience, right? And partly they're right. But I think we also need to pay attention to the argument that he's making from the position of white identitarianism. And keep in mind that in our period, for a number of reasons, it's landing its mark, right? So this will help explain why Spencer's views have enjoyed such success among millennials, why they threaten to gain more adherence in the coming years. You know, if we're going to abolish whiteness, we have to pay close attention to the context of its current insurgency, right? So when Spencer talks about white identity, he is describing something very particular. The whiteness of Spencer's white race is a race that has always existed. It is descendant from Europe. And Europe is a cultural monolith that dates back to at least ancient Rome and ancient Greece. This white identity is sole claimant to the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, the Industrial Revolution, and so forth. It has given us math, science, high culture, civil society, civilization itself, all the gadgets we like, all the cool shit, all the commodities. It's culture. It's a culture bound to race. And that culture bound to race is the culture of the so-called West. For Spencer, to assert one's white identity is to claim inheritance of nothing short of Western history, and to lay claim to the American continent, which Spencer argues was conquered by white European Westerners acting in concert to realize a common identity and destiny. In 2017, Spencer argues, white people can try to run from this historical legacy, but they can't escape it. In Spencer's words, race is real, race exists, race is the foundation of identity. Now, Spencer's formulation of a white Roman Renaissance and the white identity underneath it, from a historical perspective, are so idiotic that it's really difficult to begin taking it apart. Where do you start? Do we start with his anachronistic application of the modern conception of whiteness and the West to ancient Greece and ancient Rome, where they had no place? Or should we concede the spirit of his argument and demonstrate how indebted Greek and Roman societies were to vibrant commercial and cultural intercourse with North Africa and key cosmopolitan hubs of the Middle East and the Far East, as we call them? Do we cite the eclectic and cross-cultural influences behind Christianity, the religion of the so-called White West par excellence, which emerged from the Middle East, out of Judaism, and a hodgepodge of so-called Eastern religions, and grew in tandem with local paganism everywhere it went, and has continued to evolve to this day, taking on whatever flavor of pre-existing culture and religion it encounters? Or do we chart the development of Greek and Roman science, philosophy, technology, spirituality, and the basic principles of social organization through the Islamic Empire, which dominated the so-called West for nearly a quarter of its first two millennia? Do we follow this cultural tradition into the Renaissance, into the Enlightenment, the explosion of colonization, the Industrial Revolution, which came to be led by a few powerful European countries, but by no means can be reduced to them? Or do we chart the cultural cross-pollination between white and black Americans for hundreds of years on the North American continent, playing out, though they did, amidst a brutal power differential, but nonetheless evidenced in music, religion, art, and politics, to say nothing of this nation's physical and economic infrastructure. But no matter where we start, we must take on this conception of a transhistorical whiteness, the equation of race and culture, and the assumption of a monolithic West. Now, Amiri provided a wonderful historical context for, you know, where I'm coming from, right? And I think that a lot of us in the room already agree with this. You know, we know that a vast majority of Europeans who became white in the 19th and early 20th century, except for small pockets of cosmopolitan intellectuals and aristocrats, arrived in the U.S. with no conception of belonging to something called the West or something called the white race. Far from any kind of unifying culture, as David Roediger observes, in the early 20th century, Italian Americans could reproach each other for multiracial marriage when they married someone from a different part of Italy. Now, on the we can point out a million examples like this, and hopefully Noel can provide a few. But we can say this, and on the other hand, we have to admit that they did become white, right? They did. They made this choice, and they set the table for the situation we found ourselves in today, where race is so ingrained in the expanded reproduction of capitalism that a racialized division of labor permeates almost every aspect of society, and it can function smoothly amidst a population that, save for a small and unpopular minority, purports to reject ideological racism. We even have professional racists who say that they reject racism. This brings us back to Spencer's plan to revive the Roman Empire using Scots and Russians and whatever the fuck else. back to the happy family that we all supposedly were in the year 200 BC. It's such a stupid idea that it should elicit gales of laughter. The problem is that it doesn't, right? And it's not just that his ideas aren't taken seriously on the right. We all know that ordinary white people deprived of a multiracial class-based strategy to fight the degradations of life under neoliberalism have been lining up behind a race-based strategy put forward by folks like Spencer. We've talked about this all day, so as Shimon would say, I'm not going to put you to sleep on this. I think it's more interesting to account for the lack of a substantive left opposition to Spencer on these terms, right? Surely, most leftists hate Richard Spencer, right? A lot of people protest him. Some people punch him in the face, right? But on a conceptual level, much of the left, especially the university left, where most of the ideas about difference come from, actually share many of Spencer's basic premises about the equation of whiteness, race, and culture, and this pesky thing called the West. Now, here at the CUNY Graduate Center, Richard Spencer could actually get pretty far with his equation that white people equals their white ancestry equals all of Europe equals Greece and Rome equals the West equals the Renaissance equals the Enlightenment equals the Industrial Revolution, all of which equals white culture and white people, always has been, always will be, right? Spencer would make a lot of friends by arguing this. Where he would, of course, run afoul of the liberals is that they like to end their version of that narrative by saying, and that's bad and you shouldn't be proud of it. Spencer ends his version of that narrative by saying, no, it's good and you should be proud of it. His work is actually very easy, right? Let's see. I think of it as like a piece. There's like a piece of a pie. This the way that difference is understood in the university, like multicultural set, is this pie with a gaping empty piece. It's the forbidden piece, right? But it's created by the rest of the pie. And all Spencer needs to do is step in and provide that piece, right? And as we know, the period that we're in, these ideas have been kicking around for a long time. But the period that we're in is providing fertile soil for this to bloom. The economic restructuring known as neoliberalism has working class people divided, always on the defensive, less concentrated in the kinds of workplaces that Marx counted on to deliver us from difference than ever, and less likely than they have been in a century to struggle across racial lines in institutions like trade unions. Absent the opportunity for practicable racial solidarity, ordinary people who have no particular racial animosity baked into the deep recesses of their psyches have lapsed into struggling along sectional interests wherever they can be found, under the equation that the gain of one sectional group would entail the loss of another. These sectional interests are almost always cross-class alliances led by the bourgeoisie, and while the redistribution of wealth between races may be on the table, the redistribution of property between classes is not. Not coincidentally, this is the form that the theory of white skin privilege, the much maligned theory pioneered by our friend, has taken under neoliberalism, turning an emancipatory practice into strategies for redistributing dwindling resources while giving up the ability to turn the tide. In this climate, the neoliberal academy encourages the cultivation of elaborate racial and ethnically rooted identities, the borders of which are rigidly policed by a class of spokespeople who trade in authenticity. Remember the vitriol directed at Rachel Dolezal when white supremacists and black activists were united by a common enemy. And before the rise of Trump, explicit calls to racial difference weren't as common as replacing culture with race to mean essentially the same thing. But now we see that race is coming back. So, I guess by way of a conclusion, if it's not clear, I think that the problem of taking apart whiteness right now is as pressing as it ever was, but in the process, it's going to entail destabilizing a whole lot of other identities and a whole lot of static understandings of difference that are policed by a kind of professional class of, you know, academic and political spokespeople, you know, and we can say that they emerged for very righteous and politically necessary historical causes, but as these events play out, they will be an obstacle. It's kind of destabilizing whiteness and basically destabilizing race as it exists in our society, right? And so I'm gonna pass things along to Shimon, who I think has some things to say on this.
Okay, I will take up 5 minutes of your time.
Yes.
I have three caveats and 4 points to set this up. First, I want to say that I'm going to focus to some extent on black liberation because it foregrounds the importance of identity and whiteness in the United States. Second, I would say is that we should not jump into thinking that the debates that I have ignored the debates of people like, of groups like the Socialist Party with the African Blood Brotherhood, or Claude McKay and Harry Haywood, or C.L.R. James and Leon Trotsky. I hope the question and discussion section does not turn into lecturing any of us speakers or the audience about the importance of those people. We know that very, very clearly. Third, I'm trying to look at the developments of the past from the vantage point of today. So instead of seeing what the world looks like from the perspective of 1861 or 1917 or 1968, I'm trying to understand what the world looks like from the perspective of 2016 itself and how the past looks like that from today's vantage point. My first point is that the 20th century was shaped by two great subjects: the worker, which primarily fought at the site of the factory, and the urban space, and second, by the anti-colonial struggles, which fought at the scale of the state itself. In the United States, it was the latter, the black worker, the black nation, the black community, that centralized or crystallized these battles. And their stories captured the imagination of not only the U.S., but the world, and it helped form powerful collectivities. And yet neither were able to deliver on their promises. And both have now resulted in fractured and troubled identities or subjectivities. Second, the political results of 1968 have meant that identity and specifically race for historically oppressed groups have become a fundamental mechanism to have a relationship with the state and capital. So ideologically, this means that it's acceptable to openly bargain for your rights and benefits while one is a person of color, queer, or a woman. But if one is a straight white working class man, that mechanism is not readily apparent. And at the same time, I'm left with the contradiction of stating the obvious that the state and capital have been white supremacists and today still is so. Which has an important, there's a whole other discussion we can go down that road. Three, whiteness is not only premised on anti-blackness, but it is also a coalition with the white boss and politician. Today, the same strategy, I would argue, applies to what it means to be black, Arab, or Latina. The class collaborationist dimensions of these subjects begs the question whether the demand to be a race traitor is not just exclusive to whiteness, but a requirement for every racialized group. The development of the middle class and the bourgeoisie amongst every identity has made this possible and at the same time crucial to reject. Point number four, what does this mean in practice? First, we cannot fit the present into our historical understandings of 1968 or any given period. The material world is different, the subjectivities are different. From the vantage point of identity and looking at 1968, the rainbow coalition dreamt of by Fred Hampton became the rainbow coalition of the Democratic Party via Jesse Jackson's presidential run. And today it has devolved into identity politics for the radical left and patronage politics for the rest of society. I'm going a little faster than I thought. Okay. What I'll end on is, I hope this makes sense because I skipped a lot of stuff, but what I'll end on is we should look for possibly new subjectivities that reflect the material present. One example is the Lucasville prison uprising, where the prisoners, regardless of skin color, described themselves as the convict race. Perhaps the most well-known new quote-unquote subjectivity, for whatever its faults, was the 99% from Occupy Wall Street. I do not believe that there is any promise that any of these subjects will be a vanguard, or that we would want them to be a vanguard, or a new universal. However, considering the brutality, or the troubled history, maybe brutality is too strong a word, the troubled history of the far left in taking black oppression, as we know, those early debates that occurred in the Socialist Party and the people with the African Blood Brotherhood, or queer oppression seriously, we should be on guard for similar dynamics repeating themselves in the present and future. So what I mean by that is, these new subjectivities might not be welcomed with an open arm by the far left, because we've had, I would say the far left has had a very troubled history with doing that, and we should be on guard for that. The last point I'll say is we should experiment ourselves. Thank you.